My name is Rennie Golden, and this session is called Invasion of the America's Paradise Lost. And a good deal of the research that I did with other friends, it's a cast of thousands who wrote this book, so I won't get into all the names, but it comes from this book, which is called Dangerous Memories. And I particularly want to commend it to you, not out of any self-interest, but of all the different books that have been done on the, quote, discovery of the Americas, that in a sense sort of demythologize Columbus. There are not too many that really lift up not so much just the invasion in that moment, but look at resistance of slave and indigenous peoples across 500 years of history, from Latin America through Central America through the Caribbean through North America. So it's quite a sweep, and teachers have told us in both high school and college and with study groups that it's particularly helpful for that reason, because it compacts. Now, of course, with a sweep like that, for those of you who are historians, and I know you're here and making me nervous, I need to tell you ahead of time that I'm not a historian, that as a matter of fact, I'm an amateur historian, and that my motivation in beginning to look at history really comes from just an ethical imperative, which is to say, I think, as Al suggested this morning, that it really is the history of the disadvantaged, which is the truth about the world. And so that is a revelation. And without that knowledge, some of which is simply information, but of course it's a perspective. And it's the perspective of the dispossessed and of the marginalized, of the nobodies of history. And so to recover that history, it seems to me, is to begin to understand myself and my role in that history. And so it's that ethical imperative that has impelled my own historical studies. So I invite any of you, as the week goes on, if you stay with it, to share and fill out the overview that I will be giving. I need to tell you, this is probably not a good opener, but tonight is not the good news. To speak about the conquest is to speak about the bad news for those of us who are of European stock. Nevertheless, it seems to me that the only way through myth is to confront the truth. And that, of course, is always the road of justice. And it's sometimes a hard road. And so I'd like to begin with a quote that I think is, broadly speaking, relevant. I guess I know it. It's Dan Berrigan saying that we corrupt reality when we sentimentalize it. We inevitably sentimentalize reality until we become political. Become political where matters of life and death are concerned. He goes on to say then that the paw of Mars has eliminated the question, who will win? Which is really the history that we've known. The question now is, who will survive? And so it seems to me, at looking at this moment of 1492, we really look at many of the questions in terms of the whole question of social sin and all the isms. This is their birth, not all of them, but a good deal of them. Which is to say, well, what's the genesis of racism, of classism, of hierarchies of power? And so it's at this historical moment that we begin to see the whole question of accumulation, something that hitherto, which is not to say there weren't hierarchies before, but hitherto this was not the way that people socially and economically constructed economic patterns. Well, what was the, quote, discovery? What was this conquest? One of the voices that is good news at this historical moment is the voice of Bartolomé de las Casas, a Dominican bishop, who himself came to the New World really fascinated by the utopia, the new paradise, which historians even then were writing about and writing back to the people, I mean both historians and simply people documenting what they'd seen. And De las Casas went, and he was granted, as was any colonizer, through the encomienda system, he was granted land and slaves, and particularly as a cleric. He had a little more status. But as he came there and as he saw what was happening to the Indians and Spain's role in their decimation, he came to write back to the monarchs a plea on behalf of the indigenous people. And I'm going to read a little of that to you in a minute. His figures for what happened on the island of Hispaniola, where Columbus, one of the landing places. Now, some historians have said that he exaggerated a bit, and yet I've read a census that, in a sense, says he underestimated. He says that there were 3 million Indians, Taínos and Arawaks, on Hispaniola when Columbus landed. By 1540, there were 200 left. The census, I know some of you know this, you've been studying this in your churches, but it's going to be a review for you. The census, the official census, said that I think it was taken in 1540, said that there were 8 million people, and that by the mid-1500s there were 28,000 left. In either case, we're talking about a classic definition that didn't, the word genocide wasn't used until really World War II, when Camus began to talk about sort of classic definitions of genocide. But here we're looking at, in the whole Latin American continent, in 1492 there were 100 million Indians. Now there's 35 million. Well, how did this kind of decimation take place? Well, probably the major cause of death were diseases that the Europeans brought. Bubonic plague, smallpox, malaria, typhoid, all of which were unknown in these areas, in this area that's described as paradise. And this is Peter Martyr, a historian, describing to the Europeans what the quote discoverers and quote explorers had found. It is certain that among them the land is as common as the sun and water, and that mine and thine, the seeds of all mischief, have no place with them. The Indians are content with so little that in so large a country they have rather superfluity than scarceness, so that they seem to live in the golden world without toil, living in open gardens, not entrenched with dikes, divided with hedges, or defended with walls. They deal truly with one another, without laws, without books, and without judges. They take him for an evil and mischievous man who takes pleasure in hurting others. And I have here sections from Columbus's own log, and I know that some of you have studied those primary sources, which is what we've tried to do, is to offer people the words of the actors and subjects of history, as well as the subjugators. And Columbus himself describes the Indians as people of such generosity that they would give all if we did not stop them. Out of what they had, they would share with all. He goes on to describe the native people. Those who did not succumb and die through disease were killed by mastiff dogs, musket, steel, crossbows, where what the natives held were spears, arrows. This is De las Casas describing how they were killed who did not die of disease. Yet into this sheephold, into this land of outcasts, into the meek came the Spaniards. And these Christians, with their horses and swords and spikes, began to carry out massacres and strange cruelties against the Indians. They attacked the towns and spared neither children nor the aged nor pregnant women nor women in childbed, not only stabbing them and dismembering them, but cutting them into pieces as if dealing with sheep in the slaughterhouse. They laid bets as to who with one stroke of the sword could split a man in two or could cut off his head or spill out his entrails with a single stroke of the pike. They took infants from their mother's breast, snatching them by the legs and pitching them head first against the crags, or snatched them by their arms and threw them into the rivers, roaring with laughter and saying as the babies fell into the water, "Boil there, you offspring of the devil." Other infants they put to the sword along with their mothers and anyone else who happened to be nearby. They made some low, wide gallows on which the hanged victims' feet almost touched the ground, stringing up their victims in lots of 13, in memory of our Redeemer and his 12 apostles. Then they set burning wood at their feet and thus burned them alive. To others they attached straw or wrapped their whole bodies in straw and set them afire. With still others, all those they wanted to capture alive, they cut off hands, hung them around the victims' necks, saying, "Go now and carry the message," meaning, "Take the news to the Indians who have fled to the mountains." De Las Casas describes, as Peter Martyr did, who the Taínos and Arawaks were. These people are the most guileless, the most devoid of wickedness and duplicity, the most obedient and faithful in their native masters and to the Spanish Christians whom they serve. They are by nature the most humble, patient, and peaceable, holding no grudges, free from embroilments, neither excitable nor quarrelsome. It goes on. The other way in which people died in this moment of conquest is that Columbus introduced what he called a tribute system, originally hoping that it would be through slaves that wealth could be accumulated, that they could send slaves back to Spain, and that this would be what would please Isabel and Ferdinand. But having sent Indians back, and 60% of them either died on the voyage or when they reached Spain, died, he resorted to accumulating gold. And so the Indians were mandated through the tribute system to bring their tribute of a hawk's bell, which held approximately a quarter ounce of gold, every 3 months to the colonizers. And this was required of every man, woman, and child. If they didn't bring their hawk's bell of gold, a hand was cut off. If they did it twice, a foot could be cut off. The third time, they were simply killed. Pedro Hernando Cobas is a Taíno descendant of the natives who were on the island of Cuba. And when an Indian anthropologist attempting to gather data for this quincentenary year went to Cuba to interview the natives there, he spoke with one of the older natives. And Pedro Hernando Cobas pointed to the cliffs. This is on one of the far reaches of Cuba, and he pointed to the cliffs. And this is where you see the long reach and the danger of memory. And he said, "This is where our people jumped off the cliffs in despair when they could no longer bear the tribute system." And this is a direct quote from Pedro Cobas, a living representative of that time. "I would say Columbus, Colón, and his people treated us in a bad manner. We suffered susto, fright. The treatment they gave us was pure whip. The conquistador lied about the Indian. They said we were stupid, imbeciles. But I think the old Indians knew a lot. I think that our ancestors were good, quiet people. They didn't like to hurt anyone. But they ended up whole families jumping off the cliffs to avoid the slavery. Here our Indian people have been like a fish in a cooler, eyes open but seeing nothing. For many years, nobody spoke about about anything Indian. Not for a long, long time. And so this recovery of dangerous memory and this record of De Las Casas. You know, when I first read De Las Casas and when I began to read the letter of a lieutenant who watched the Trail of Tears, the Cheyennes walking, and told that story. And when I read the letter of one of the Indian guides who went as a guide for General Shivington and told the story of Sand Creek, where Chief Black Kettle had put up a, had always flown an American flag whenever the Indians were in the village or camped, because he said he sought peace. And then you read this account, a direct account, in the words of someone who was there. And he tells of soldiers surrounding the village and then going in, and the first thing they do is to massacre the braves, of which there were very few. It is always women and children. And then the story of a little boy coming up from one of the trenches that had been dug, and the squaws were there, and they sent a little boy out with a white flag. And he tells of the child being shot in the spot, and then the men descend upon the women, rape and kill them. And he says that every single one of them were scalped. And he told of women, just as De Las Casas did, having their bellies cut open and fetuses thrown beside them. When I read that, I just absolutely wept. And yet, I think if I had not gone to El Salvador, and if I had not interviewed and spoken to a survivor of El Mozote, which is a village in Morazan, where within a 48-hour period, 1,000 people of El Mozote were incinerated in an air bombardment, which Alexander Coburn, writing in The Nation, said is the worst air offensive and devastation of the Americas in this century, and no one even knew about it, and that you and I and our tax dollars paid $1.5 million per day to support that army. If I had not been there and talked to that survivor, I would have thought this was all hyperbole. And people still, I mean, De Las Casas did romanticize in some ways, but he also was telling the truth of someone who was an eyewitness. And it just, it's not a stretch once you see the implications now. Or to have spoken with survivors of Rio Sumpul, where 600 women and children were fleeing across the Rio Sumpul, and the Honduran military trained rifles on them until the Salvadoran military could come up behind them. And the reports were quashed by the Hondurans and silenced by the United States, but a priest had a Brownie camera, and he came up and saw it, and saw the fishermen taking the babies who had been bayoneted in fishing nets out of a river that had turned red with blood, and then sent the report to the London Times. Only then did we get this story. This is all hidden. These massacres are simply hidden from us, but they continue. Well, what's the genesis of this? Well, it seems to me that there are a particular set of ideas, I mean, this whole sort of notion of ideology, and it's very much tied up with not simply the state, but with the church. So now, where was the church in all of this? Well, let me try to read to you the Treaty of Tordesillas. This is where Pope Alexander VI essentially, the church had the role of deciding upon what nations would be able to colonize what areas. And so this treaty is essentially a papal bull. And I'm just going to read to you a little section of it. Think of the mentality of this, but also think of the relationship of state and church. And this, of course, will solidify the development of what, at this very moment, and I'll try to say a little bit more about what state Europe was in at the moment of the discovery. I'm going a little bit backwards, but it seems important to know what was going on in Europe. So I'll try to do that in a minute. But this is going to solidify and consolidate the nation state, which Isabel and Ferdinand have done quite well, but here's their support, or here's the sacralization, in a sense, of these arrangements, if I can find it. Oh, brother. You know what? I'm going to have to come back to it, but I really like to read the words because they're so... they're so revelatory. But essentially, certainly not like Solomon, but essentially, Alexander VI says, we're going to divide the Americas. Portugal will get this half, and he has an actual demarcation line. And Spain will get the other half. And there's absolutely, if you read the language, that includes the peoples, the lands. First of all, as if land, you know, simply can be taken in those terms, and it can be declared the empires. Well, I'd like to come back to read that, because I found that one just incredible, to read the particular language of this papal bull. But more than that, there is another, well, one might call this a certain attempt at limiting the devastation of the conquistadors on the part of the church. Now, in some cases, the monarchs didn't really know all that the colonizers was all that was being perpetrated. I mean, they didn't exactly tell them how they got, or how they, in a sense, discovered certain lands. At the same time, you've got De las Casas writing back and making it abundantly clear. And so one of the attempts at humanizing this conquest was what was called the requerimiento. And that was, you were required, any conquistador was required to read to the people who were about to be basically repressed and killed. They were required to read a particular statement which said that they were about to be Christianized, and it was their choice, basically, to, you know, to surrender or die. And let me just read the requirement. I hope I didn't lose that one, too. This is just now a segment of it. This is one of the things that Hernan Cortes did as he conquered the Aztecs in Mexico, so that they would be sometimes a mile or two outside the town, and some scribe would read this thing, I mean, in the dead of night, and it would go something like this. This is to inform you that the king's summons will, if you do not accept, this is Christianity, we will powerfully invade and make war upon you in all parts and modes, so that I can subdue you to the yoke and obedience of the church and of his majesty. And I will take your effects and will do all the harm and injury within my power as vassals who will not obey or receive their sovereign and resist or oppose him. And I protest that the death and disasters which may come about because of this action will be the fault of yourselves and not of his majesty, nor of me, who carries out his bidding and his will. And this in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. So this was required. In other words, you couldn't just go in and slash and burn. You had to read this.
This was in Spanish, though.
Oh, yeah, right. Should people here be saying to themselves, well, this isn't a newsflash. I mean, this is the papacy. If we go a century further and we look at the way in which the pilgrims, in terms of religious ideology, approached, or that's the new language. If you don't want to say conquered, you're supposed to say encountered. You know, what do you mean encountered? In any case, the indigenous of this country, what you find is another form of this. And I'll try to say a little bit about that in terms of the role of the church, except that it shifts. You have a new sense of of the elect of God. And the Indians, with whom the Spanish would, in spite of the atrocities I've told you about, would intermarry. I mean, and this is how we get a whole Ladino class, the mestizo. For the Puritans, there would not even be that, because the Indians became demonized. They became villains in a sacred drama. And so there would not even be that much interrelationship. So more needs to be said about that, to be specific about manifest destiny and the implications of all of that. But I jump ahead. I want to, you know, in terms of what I hope will be the good news of this attempt to look historically back 500 years. In the next 3 days, I'd like to look at African-American resistance. I'd like to look at Native American, indigenous resistance across continents. And that, of course, is the good news. That is, those are the people who survived. And those are the people who carried hope through what was essentially an inferno. And I say that to encourage you, because this first night, and I'm not through yet, is not uplifting, to say the very least. But when I talk about this notion of simple survival, but more than survival, to have resisted, to have said no to death in the formation that I'm talking about, to have said no with a whole people's strength, is a whole different approach to history. And it is no longer to be simply crucified, but it is to be resurrected, is to say that you cannot kill a people's spirit as long as someone remembers the people, who they are, where they've come from, and how they refused to be subjugated. Now, I say this because a metaphor that I think is particularly instructive for me about this sort of different notion of suffering is a metaphor that José Martí used at the turn of the century, seeing that Central America would be, having already experienced what happened in Nicaragua with United States Marines coming in, looking at what he saw as a fire that would sweep Central America, which of course we've seen certainly in the last 12 years. Martí, looking at all of this, knowing that it would be the hour of the furnaces, had this to say, and I think it's a metaphor for this notion of dangerous memory and memories of fire. He said, "Now is the hour of the furnaces. Only light should be seen." And that's been the particular faithfulness, it seems to me, of peoples of color who would be confronted with this onslaught that has lasted these 500 years. An example of the resistance I'm talking about came from a chief, I believe in Hispaniola, named Hatui. And I think all of you probably have done any of this research. It's probably a particularly famous story. Hatui had fled to avoid the tribute system. He had fled with some of the other people within his tribes, young men, because they were fast enough to get away. And they sent out some troops to try to round them up, but they couldn't find them. And it was probably the beginning of guerrilla warfare. And so they had hidden in the further reaches. And finally, it took months and months, but it was important to get Hatui back, because this could spread, this kind of running away. Spread, we're going to watch 500 years of this. In any case, they brought him back, and he was to be literally burned alive. And they had mounted, as they were wont to do, sticks, and he was a chief. And so before they would burn him alive, a friar went up to him, and in fact, there's a picture of him with a sort of long stick with a cross on the end of it. And he holds that into the flames for Hatui, but before he does that, he goes up to him and he says to him, "My child, do you seek salvation?" Hatui says, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, it means that you will enter heaven and you will be with says, and Hattui says to the priest, will Christians be in heaven? And he said, yes, that is what heaven is. And Hattui says, then I never want to go to heaven. And so he ends his life with this refusal. Well, what was Europe like at this particular moment and what was happening there? All kinds of events were converging at this moment of 1492. One of them, I think, would maybe kind of start us off. You know, conquering a people, we're going to look at, requires a highly developed militarization of a culture. One has to learn relocation techniques. One has to learn appropriation techniques. One has to learn technological warfare techniques. And then deportation techniques. All of these had been practiced in Europe because there was now a need for what they call the Reconquista, which would be to reconquer and unify Europe, and specifically now Spain, and to drive the Moors out, which was all but accomplished in 1492, except for Granada. And Isabel and Ferdinand had joined both Castile and Aragon through their marriage, and really were the sort of forerunners of the nation state, which was, in a sense, entering history at this moment. They, however, were still economically weak because the nobles and the aristocracy owned 95% of the land, and they had the wool trade through their ownership of sheep, so that masses of the peasants, of course, had nothing. And in fact, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz says that the first colonized in Europe were the peasants. And then she says, then there were nations that were colonized, Bohemia, Ireland. I'm alluding to. And then, of course, it's at this very moment of 1492 that the Sephardic Jews will be deported and sent out of Spain. And it is, in fact, because the Jews who were merchants and successful business people, who would have been part of the business sector that would have sponsored Columbus's voyage, the way in which the voyage would be paid for, because neither Isabel nor Ferdinand had the kind of financial support that would be necessary, though they would, again, make league with some of the merchants, it was to take all the possessions and the lands of the Jews who would be deported. At that moment. In fact, the only acknowledgement of that deportation just took place this year, 1492, in Spain, and then with a great deal of reluctance. In any case, so you have this happening, and what's going to fund this trip? Well, to a great extent, it's going to be the accumulation of these lands and wealth of the Jews. So this is happening at the same time. In 1492, you have Isabel and Ferdinand needing to sort of redirect this war machine. I mean, there have been 7 centuries now of this attempt to regain and reconquer Spain. And it's all but accomplished. And in fact, when they came to power, and when they joined their powers in, I guess, 1469, the nobles, once they had retaken Spain, and the Crusades had accomplished that, were fighting with each other over lands. So they redirected them to take Granada. Well, once Granada was taken, the question then was, what do you do with them? And I say this because it's a question that we're continually confronted with. What do you do with a militarized state? Because if it isn't directed, it's going to become internal. And so, of course, the new lands would become a way in which to kind of shape and send that forward. Well, at the same time, the printing press is invented. Now, this is just revolutionizing. I say all of this because there's a tremendous amount of parallel between Europe then and now, and I'm going to try to make those parallels in a minute. In fact, there was a scribe that went to the court of Isabel with one of the new books that had been printed. And Isabel was busy with other things. And the scribe said to Isabel, Your Highness, I want to present this to you. And she says, What do I want with this? And the scribe says, Your Highness, language is more precious than gold. He or she who controls the language controls the world. And I say this because this is something that Isabel would learn, and this is very much part of the cultural conquest. It's one thing to send in arms, but how do you actually take over and try to, in a sense, erase memory, erase the people's sense of who they are? Well, a lot of it has to do with how you name the world. Who names the world to a great extent controls it. Some small examples of that are, if I would just raise your hand now, if you have heard of this name before, who's heard of Hernan Cortez? De Soto, Ponce de Leon, Magellan, Marcela Bastides, Tupac Amaru, Canek, Cinque, Captain Tomba, Denmark Vesey, David Walker, Toussaint Louverture, Dessalines. The language, the names that we know are of the conquerors. We don't know those who resisted. Michaela Bastides was the wife of Tupac Amaru. Brilliant strategist leading one of the most successful resistances against the Spanish conquistadors in Latin America. I've named Captain Tomba, who was able to take a slave ship and try to return it to their lands. Cinque, another slave. Toussaint Louverture, leading the most successful struggle against imperialism in the history of the world, in which slaves rose up, defeated the British, defeated the Spanish, defeated the French, and formed the first slave rebellion that takes state power, begins to run a nation. This will be turned around, but in any case, we don't even know this history of Haiti, of Santo Domingo. So the history of the underside is lost. When I talk about language, any of you just tell me some language right now in terms of the language we've been taught about the, quote, discovery. Language which already, it seems to me, is a language that was given to us. Can you just give me some words that you might question the implications of those words in talking about the new world? One is obvious. Okay, you could say to me, "Well, I don't think it was a discovery. You know, I think it was an invasion." But the language we have is discovery. Can you think of any other words like that? I feel like I'm asking one of those questions. You know, I have the answer, and so everybody kind of what she wanted to know. Well, they're obvious. I mean, if I say them, you'd start to get in a roll. But for instance, the language was, and all the Europeans wrote about this, that they had discovered a wilderness, that they had discovered virgin land, that there were primitives there, savages. I mean, it gets worse, then it goes on, heathens. But in any case, for openers. Or there's this sort of paternalism of, sort of innocent children, childlike people. Every one of those languages is based on an incredible assumption. What wilderness? I mean, we're talking about 2,000 languages, talking about a highly populated, high culture of people. What was wild? What was virgin? I mean, we're talking loaded with land, with people, which is paradisial in terms of it. Who was savage? I mean, after I read De las Casas, who was savage? So You know, I mean, it started with us learning in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, but it's all language that was able to name this event instead of our being able to critically learn from the people who were the recipients of this, quote, discovery. Well, to try to talk about Europe at this time, coming back to this, I've tried to name some of the events that were happening at this moment and how that would shape what was not, the sort of notion we've had of this powerful nation just seeking more discovery for the sake of knowledge and to bring culture. But on the contrary, the situation was, I think, a lot like our situation now, which is to say, it was a cataclysmic moment. It was a revolutionized moment. It was a pre-industrial moment. It was a moment when economies were being reshaped, when you'll now have, with this, quote, discovery, the ability to accumulate capital, and so you have this whole different mindset about the world in economic terms that will take place. And, of course, the very language that I've talked about, heathens, wilderness, etc., there will be a mindset about people of color that will follow. What I'll be talking about tomorrow is when Indians as slaves were killed off or died, then Africans would be brought to work the land and to accumulate for the colonizers. Roxanne Dunbar, and I'd like to quote her if I could find this, defines this at the moment when you have the racism will be systematized and institutionalized later, but this is the beginning of it. This is where you attribute to peoples of color characteristics that are different than the Europeans, which is different in terms of inferior, different in terms of not having the same superior qualities of European culture. At the same time, capitalism is beginning now with mercantilism. And this is at a moment where there's a switch from an agrarian economy. There will be a shift. I mean, this is going to be gradual. And in fact, I have a particularly cogent quote about this moment from Kirkpatrick Sales, who I think is one of the sort of key historians on this moment. So this is a moment of obviously empire. So you have imperialism, you have capitalism, you have racism. And all of these isms are dawning at this particular moment, and then you have the role of Christianity in its attempt to, quote, save the heathen. Let me just do this quote of Ortiz, if I can find it. Well, this is not the quote I was looking for, but basically she's saying, for the first time in history, the majority of people depended on a minority for a livelihood, a phenomena associated with colonialism. So, and this is new in the world. So we have this particular system being exported, and we'll see that for the next 500 years. William Appleman Williams says that the rise of mercantilism is the story of a struggle to adopt Christian morality during a dynamic secularization of religion, just at the moment that an agrarian society is transformed into a society of commerce and industry. So it's this moment. Now, we are in a moment that is hardly describable. We're in it, just as the Europeans probably couldn't know the implications of all that this meant. And so, as I suggested when I opened, there's a tendency to romanticize or sentimentalize the moment until you're very clear on what are the full implications. So we have, at this historical moment, with the end of the Cold War, with Eastern Europe absolutely seeking freedom, codified in democracy, but really ending up with sort of running after the consumption patterns of the West, and identifying that as democracy, and you have ethnocide virtually happening in Eastern Europe. At the same time, Western Europe is attempting to unify, and probably doing that better than the other two blocks of power at this moment, which is Japan and parts of Southeast Asia, as well as the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Mexico has already probably been double-crossed. But the point is, we've got this whole new moment after the Cold War in which people don't even know what's next. And we have, in the empires, tremendous internal problems. I mean, L.A. is just sort of one explosion. And as James Baldwin said, there will be a fire next time. I mean, it isn't put out. So you've got the people in the sort of internal colonies of the empire exploding, and then you've got the third world in a more desperate situation than it ever was throughout the Cold War. So just trying to say that the kind of chaos we're confronting and the sort of we don't know what's next. Now, I say that we have this moment economically where we no longer have a bipolar world, which, however much we could say the two imperial powers of the United States and Russia tended to demonize each other and divide up the world and be the world's policeman, there was some stability in that. We now have a multipolar world, and it's people don't even know where we're at. The market, what we see beginning here, the market has won. And what that means is death for the poor nations. And I know you've been in these other workshops, and you look at what the implications are ecologically for the world at this moment. We are in a desperate moment. But the roots of this go back. And somebody told me, you know, to even live with the statistic that 40,000 people died of starvation today is staggering. One would choke on their food. Well, you know, this is a world market in which if things were divided equally, if we had a different kind of an economy, not based on accumulation but human need, then everyone could eat. And yet we see not the breakup of that, but in a sense we see that it is that kind of an economy that is just one and is and the wealth is even more concentrated than ever before. So what do you do in the face of that? I mean, and the fact that this sort of economic transformation is taking place at this moment, I mean, it is a new form in terms of the electronic technology. The patterns of accumulation are now sort of accumulating knowledge. We don't even know what it means yet. I mean, the full implications of it, I think, are staggering to us. If the printing press would change the mentality of Europe, computers have done that for us. So how that all fits together and what kind of chaos we're in, it seems to me there's parallels. So what are the ways in which we have to challenge sort of that imperial mentality? Well, I did a lot of talking tonight, and I'm hoping tomorrow for me not to be the sort of focus, but I'd like to do an experiment so that in a way I think you can understand the mentalities of all, including the Europeans in this role. I'd like to do a kind of a simulation in which everybody here would take some part and have to work out a piece of the puzzle. So that would be one of the things we do tomorrow, and also to talk about sort of the philosophies that developed at this moment, because that kind of gets at the what were Europeans thinking, from humanism through rationalism through materialism. All of these come about, and what are the implications? But I don't want you to think it's a sort of philosophical discussion. I've done the talking tonight. Tomorrow I'd like to hope with just this output that I could hear from other people. The last thing I'd like to do now, and I'm just, you know, we have about 15 minutes because we started a little bit late, would be to ask you if you might try this in a kind of a short period of time. Let me get my notes on this. If you were to describe the theology of these five sectors or people, what do you think the theology was of Bartolomé de las Casas? What was the theology of Alexander VI? What was the theology of the Taino and Arawak Indians? Call it spirituality. What was the theology of Ferdinand and Isabel? If you were to think of those five, I have Columbus down too, but let's assume Columbus was not much of a theologian, although he was very religious. And in fact, one of the ways in which he persuaded these monarchs, he donned the habit of a Franciscan and fasted when he came back after the second voyage. So very pious man. If I were to say to you, what are the theologies, and I were to give you three categories of theology that come from the South Africans in terms of their Kairos document, and just do them very briefly. They talked about three theologies. One was state theology, in which essentially the state is God. And this isn't so far-flung. I mean, I've heard, you know, in my lifetime, presidents sign off with a particular foreign policy and say at the end, you know, and God bless you all, and a policy that for me was just an absolute expression of sinfulness. So there's... so there's state theology, and then there's church theology. This one is a little bit trickier. Church theology obviously has a lot to do with the institutional church, but in this theology, there's a real, the language that's used, and it's very sincere, is a language of reconciliation. The real problem is, how would you reconcile the Europeans with the Indians? I mean, what would be the way in which you'd reconcile them? Or how do you reconcile a woman who's been raped with a rapist? Who has to reconcile? The raped woman? The native people? What would reconciliation, you know, who's the initiator of that? So there's a tremendous emphasis in church theology on reconciliation. I could probably say a lot more. I want to go fast. And the last one is prophetic theology. And this is theology that calls into question every power arrangement except radical mutuality or radical democracy, however you would have it. That is to say, the true expression in political and economic terms that we are truly brothers and sisters. I mean, not a pious expression, but the actual structural expression of that, and that all else is to be challenged. Well, with those three kinds of theologies, I guess I'm going to just ask you if you would. I'm going to ask you to turn to just a partner, and I'd like you to try to categorize, and I'll just put them on the board for a minute. Take any one of them, and don't take the easy ones. Just because I think a few are kind of write-offs. What do you think, I mean, if you could put it in any terms that you want, could you express the theology of, and I just would like to put these on the board. I'm doing this, I think, probably too fast because I should have you count off. But I'd rather you would just do this with a partner. If you could kind of express this. So let me just try this. Do I have a couple minutes left, or have I lost
one or two?
I don't have time. All right. Okay.
I think that's a question you can leave people with. I'm going to tell you about the mission.
I'm going to tell you about the mission right now.
That's a question everybody can think about.
Okay. Okay. I lost time. I thought I would. Well, tonight at 9:00, there is a movie which is based on a real. I mean, it's simply the story of the Guarani Indians and Jesuits who came to, quote, Christianize them, and the particular dilemma theologically that this Jesuit mission was confronted with, and, of course, the role of both church and state in all of this. It's an incredible movie based on, as I've suggested, I mean, actual documents of the true record of this story of the Guarani, and in fact how they were wiped out. Timothy Irons represents what classically speaking we would call the sort of nonviolent approach. And Robert De Niro represents what might be called more of a liberation theology approach. The thing that's incredible about this is whichever of these sides you take, and I think this is what I've been trying to say, whichever strategy one might use to resist, the Guarani are wiped out. And you begin to see what superior firepower is against these sort of great and stout hearts. There is also, for anybody who'd like to be in a discussion later, I'd love to have the discussion. This is just one shot I'll get in. There's this incredible ending in which Jeremy Irons, he's sort of the Dan Berrigan. Dan Berrigan is actually in the movie at the beginning. He's sort of the Dan Berrigan, and he comes out in the end. This is the sort of nonviolent. And I just want I'm not going to tell the ending, but I just want the women in the crowd to tell me if there's any woman alive who would walk out with children at her side, holiness ciborium, and face death. It's just incredible. Your instinct would be to cover the kids, to take them. Just such a... It's just very surprising. But in any case, it's a wonderful movie. I recommend that you see it. And thanks for coming.
Thank you.